We'll call the committee to order, although I hesitate to do this, having just heard from Krista that she was 10 minutes away this evening and went home to walk a dog. She's been driving for 40 minutes without managing to get here. But we'll see if we can manage to do it without having her here. So we'll do an apology in advance. Anyway, we're continuing today with the Department of Revenue, which is starting to talk about some of the issues that the big combination revenue issues and information policy issues that we're going to have to deal with. So we're starting today with the Department of Revenue to tell us about the integrated tax project proposal.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It was a delightful walk up from the Bassin building on all fours. I hope you all still have a copy of the handout that we were working off of last time I was here.
We kept it for everybody.
We are anxious to share with you information about our integrated tax systems project. We're very excited about it. I think we have a lot of good news to share with you today on that. On your copy, I think it's page 6, top of page 6, we'll start there. Obviously, one of the budget change items in the governor's budget is to continue funding the integrated tax project. I want to give you a little background of why we even got into this project. I think it's pretty clear that over the years, agencies have not been very flush with money to dedicate to IT, and sort of the world got ahead of us in terms of what was capable in terms of the administration of taxes and other types of things that agencies do, and the funds to buy the necessary IT have not generally been available, at least to the extent that we would have needed. If you look at the first slide on page 6, the problem we were dealing with as we contemplated changing our systems is the fact that we were at that up until recently, and to some extent currently, we were using 142 different computer applications in order to process and do the administrative work of the 28 taxes that we administered. 142 different computer applications running on 11 different platforms, different types of systems. I don't have to tell you that that's probably not the best way to operate. Depending on who you talk to in the department in those in this kind of situation, if you had a question about, if a taxpayer had a question about their account or their refund, it was not impossible to have several answers to the same question when you have that many systems operating. So we knew it was time to do something. Various tax types had multiple applications that employees would have to use to get information. It was pretty clear that our operating costs under these conditions were escalating. Just to maintain the old systems, and in some cases, the vendors of these platforms were not going to be supporting them for the long term. So we were facing the prospect of having to replace them. Our ability to provide the kind of modern 21st century taxpayer services to our taxpayers certainly would not be facilitated by the kind of systems we had. Getting information was not an easy thing, again, because of the variations in the various systems. And for our employees, if they moved from one division to another, let's say they took a promotion and they went from sales tax to income tax, generally they have to spend a lot of time in training to learn new systems that were specific to the tax type that they were being transferring to. So we have the risk of disruption also. We were very concerned about the ability of our system to continue on and be available for future use. And so part of our interest in building a new system was to avoid the risk of disruption and failure of these very critical systems. And finally, I think we all recognize that when we get a more modern set of tools in place, eventually down the road, we'll probably be a little more efficient, hopefully a lot more efficient in tax administration. And so we expect out of the completion of this project that we will have a greater degree of compliance with the tax law. Well, I talked about the problems. The colored chart that you see on the bottom of page 6 is, I think, a pretty nice graphical depiction of the variety of systems that we were using and to some extent are still using because we're not obviously completing, finished with the installation of the new system. Every block there that is a different color signifies a different system. So if you look down the left-hand side, you see that there's homogeneity in terms of working on policy, the gray role. But if you're talking about the identity of taxpayers and maintaining that information, you see some variety of systems. And as you go along, you can see the hodgepodge of systems that we rely on even today. Well, the good news is that we are making progress now in an integrated tax system. I want to talk about the benefits, and to a great extent, it will be the problem to the negative side or the reverse of the problem. If we have, when we complete the what we call the integrated tax system, and I'll talk more about the labels so you don't get confused. We will have more accurate, more timely, and more complete information from a single source. Have more uniform information. Our citizens and our employees will be able to go to one place for information. One place means one answer, and the answer will be the right one. We will have the ability to greatly expand and enhance services. One of the options for this project that we will have to deal with and discuss internally is an option available to us called taxpayer access, It's a strategic issue we'll have to make as to whether we go in that direction, but there are some things that would afford us, allow us to do that we can't currently do now. We certainly expect reduced costs from having a more efficient system. The system will have the same functionality, the same look and feel, regardless of whether you're working on a sales tax issue or a property tax, or not a property sales tax or income tax, or any number of the taxes. I should mention property taxes are sort of off to the side and not part of this project. We'll have enhanced capabilities to detect non-compliance and increase tax collections without tax law changes. That's always a good thing. We expect longer term to see revenue increases as a result of having this more modern tax system. So if you flip over to the next page, a little more on the status of where we are on this. We got some legislation in 2007, and that allowed us to move forward with a proposal, a competitive bid, for what we called a commercial off-the-shelf package. We were very biased in the sense that we wanted a package that would be somewhat like when you buy a Windows package and you get Windows version X and then you install it and on an annual basis you get upgrades. We wanted that processing system to be kind of like that. We didn't want to be in the business of having to rebuild the system every couple of years or so. So we were very clear in our RFP that we wanted a commercial off-the-shelf package, not a custom build. Now, we were kind of emphatic on that, in part because we had knowledge of the fact that there are now, 12 or 13 states in the country that are using a system called Gentax. And it's provided by a company called Fast Enterprises. Fast Enterprises is a company that whose principals are, in many cases, former tax administrators. They have one line of business, and it's tax administration. And they have their track record in the states that they have installed the system is absolutely stellar, on time and on budget in every situation. In some cases, they've been called in to clean up a mess that was created by a previous contractor. So they do have quite a reputation. So we went out with a competitive bid. in August of 07, and we wrote a contract with Fast Enterprises signed on February 2008, and the work began the following month. Another unique aspect of this contractor is they make a commitment to have, in our case, 20 to 25 of their people on site for the duration of the project. They've taken up residence in Minnesota and are working side by side with our employees to do the implementation.
Okay, there's a couple of questions or comments. I think Representative Downey first.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Back to your previous slide about the benefit. A couple things that I didn't see, and I'm curious if you could comment on them. First, are there customer service?
The one that's at the top of page 7? Is that the one that we're looking
yeah.
at? Okay.
Yes. Okay. Customer service or kind of cycle time improvements or process improvements, are there benefits that citizens will actually feel?
We think there are. And currently, I mean, right now, our use of e-filing has been a great benefit to taxpayers. We are number one in the country, as you, I think, heard last time we were here. Having a system that we can rely on and know that the data in it and the data we get from it is going to be accurate is going to be a tremendous benefit for taxpayers. Depending on if you're a taxpayer calling in now, I'd like to think you're going to get the right answer depending on who you call. I don't have 100% confidence in that right now. With this one source system where everything comes from one unified system, the likelihood of getting the right answer is going to be much improved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up. Maybe two follow-ups. Did you identify kind of at the beginning of the project where those customer service improvements would be, and are you restructuring your internal processes and your staffing as a result of this? And if you could, just a brief description of that.
When we were in the process of identifying vendors, a number of us, and I personally was involved in several of these trips, we went out and visited states that had implemented or in the process of implementing the product that we're talking about here. And we interviewed the employees of those revenue departments. And I was very impressed in the tour that I had. I think we were in Idaho and New Mexico and a few other states.
Arizona.
We went to warm places. But I was very impressed with what I heard from their employees. The enthusiasm was infected. It contagious. And the folks in the phone center, for example, talked about how they had all this access, all this data right in front of them on various screens, and they could pull up the account of a taxpayer. They could put a tax note about the taxpayer onto the computer so they could see the entire history of that taxpayer's account. They could also go in and tap other databases that the state has to get information to cross-check and so on. So I saw things going on in those states that we were not equipped to do in our departments with the systems that we had.
One quick thought. Did OEP participate then in their customary oversight role with
OEP
you?
Has been very supportive of this project right from the box. As soon as we knew that we were going in this direction, I spent some time with Gopal Khanna to brief him on what we were doing. He's very helpful to us, has a number of suggestions. We're very pleased with the support we've had from them on this, and they've been in the loop on it all along. And I think maybe when John has a chance to come up, he might want to add some comments about our relationship. It's been very good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, this looks like an overall very good project, a huge one, and no question, very complicated. My question, though, too, is since you rolled this out in, you began it in March of 2008 and it's rolled it out, you know, the particular kinds of uses, I know there's a withholding tax, there's a Minnesota e-filing system, is this part of that e-filing system, or is that something different?
This is sort of, it would be, it's different. It's after the e-filing that currently takes place. Now, of course, e-filing is you're talking about business and individual taxpayers. This would be sort of an add-on to that at this point. I mentioned earlier the TAP thing, the taxpayer access point, I think is what it stands for. If we decide, and we need to look at that very carefully, if we decide to add that piece to the project, it would provide a new interface with taxpayers to a large degree.
And can I follow up? One of the things that, you know, there's kind of sometimes if you build it, they will come. And no question about it, we have no choice. We have to pay our taxes. And the biggest thing is that there are the internal customers, the employees who use the system. We certainly want them as customers to have, you know, real input into the design of the system because they're the ones that have to do a lot of the work. But the other are the external customers. Have you had focus groups with taxpayers? Have you had focus groups with accountants and with others to review this kind of a system and say, does this work for those who are going to be filing?
We've had meetings with some of the practitioner groups. They're aware of the project that's going on. I've presented myself at some venues about the project. So whether we've done enough, I can't say, but the focus has been more internally. What do we have to do internally to make this happen? How do we get our employees pumped up about it? In many cases, you have to take people off of their regular job and say, for a while, you're going to be working on this new project. And that's been a challenge for us because their old work still has to get done. There are issues of compensation when you move people around. And, you know, it's been a challenge. So we've spent a lot of time internally trying to make sure that our folks were comfortable with it. And I think if you were to just take a random sample of our employees, you would find a high degree of enthusiasm.
Madam Chair and Mr. Salamone, I appreciate that, and I understand with the employees, and that certainly is a very, very important thing. But my emphasis, once again, is including your actual filings, your people, regular citizens, CPAs, attorneys, and other those who are included in the design element, not just listened to or told what's going to happen, but where they actually include, because they're very knowledgeable and they can be a tremendous asset to you in helping you in either choosing functionality or choosing in priorities which ones mean the most to taxpayers, to filers, to the CPAs, to the attorneys, to those who are totally on the outside and are not employees.
My name is Greg Kidd. I'm with the Department of Revenue, Madam Chairman, committee members. I might be able to add a little bit more clarity here. The tax types that were chosen in rollout one, and we actually did a lot of work trying to figure out which tax types we should go with, were actually chosen because we could do this with transparent to the businesses that we did. They would still work with our current filing system, the e-file system that you mentioned and the rest. And so their processes and the rest really didn't change at all at this point in time. On our work plan, which right now, which Dan mentioned, we are looking at the taxpayer access point. And there is, in the works, planning to bring tax practitioners and employees in the past. I also will say that I have worked on a number of systems for the department, and I will tell you when we did the sales tax system and when we did the income tax system, we do bring in focus groups, exactly as you're saying, to try and have them say, does this work for you? Because they are our partners and our main partners. Right now, on our sales tax and our withholding taxes, we are almost at 100% of people filing electronically. And that is because we have worked with them to try and make it happen. We also did mandate it. So that's another piece of it. But we worked to make sure because we knew if we were going to mandate it, we better be able to perform with it. And that's one of the reasons why we are really spending a lot of time analyzing the taxpayer access point. Nice functionality, but is it going to give us the same type of service that we can give to people right now? As a matter of fact, we want to give them more, but potentially they could come in and they could look at, ooh, what were my estimated payments? And they can come in and see the same information that we're looking at. Does that help answer your question?
Yes, Madam Chair, that does. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if you had counted any staff reductions in the benefits section here, or if you would count that.
Certainly not, Madam Chair, Representative, certainly not in the short run. It's been a challenge to get the resources internally redeployed to do this project.
We are. One of the things that we committed to when we came before the legislature is said that we would put this in and we would cover any ongoing tail costs on an ongoing basis through our own budgets with staff reductions and the rest. I mean, by going with this integrated tax system, one of the things that we inherited is the fact that we knew that we were going to now have an annual maintenance payment of approximately $1 million because you buy the software, and that way you get the update. So 4 years from now, when we're all done, we're on the most current version, and we, you know, it keeps going so that not every 4 years I come up and say, oh, please give me tens of millions of dollars so I can build a new system. It's deliberate. We have to find some way in our area to cover that maintenance cost, because right now that isn't a cost that we have had to bear enough. That will happen through staff reductions and the rest. So then you're going to get those. You're going to also get differences in jobs as people's positions change, you know, they will fill. We are not looking right now, except that we've got another 3.5 years worth of the project. It's really tough to say this position is going at this point in time. We have earmarked areas where we're looking for them, and I'm actually charged with capturing where those savings are so that when you get to the end of the project, they're there to cover these types of costs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess a whole bunch of questions. First one is start off with the one you just mentioned about documenting savings, basically, or other kinds of things. Is that going to be are there incremental reports that you could provide us as you roll out these systems? You know, the whole thing you're not going to know about, but you might know about rollout of phase one. You might have a progress report on what that has done to your internal staff, customer service, that sort of thing. So I think it might be helpful at least to get periodic reports on what you're learning so far. The second, you mentioned this, the issue of maintenance and supporting new versions coming out, etc. What is the expected life cycle of this system, and what's the long term, or what is the term of commitment from the vendor to continue to support it and maintain it going forward?
It is my understanding, working with the vendor, that it is a perpetual product. I mean, it is something that you know, they are on, I believe, version 6 right now. And they continue to upgrade it. There are major and minor upgrades, just like any software package. This is their livelihood. This is the only thing that they do. And so they are committed to making it better and better. And as Dan had mentioned, they are now up to, I believe, 14 states, 2 or 3 provinces in Canada, Trinidad and Tobago. So they are really still out marketing this, and it is still a growth area, because what they can do then is that they develop functionality, they can spread it out over a number of things where individually it would be very expensive for us to develop this type of functionality, but when you're spreading it out over 12. So it's that. Our commitment to them right now, and I think it's pretty much because of the purchasing rules and the rest, is we were allowed, working with the Department of Finance and the Department of Administration, ours was for a 5-year commitment at this point in time.
And Madam Chair, I guess I don't know if that, it seems like that actually may be fairly short for a system.
Yeah, and we'll renegotiate when we get after 3 years.
Because I guess my concern is that at some point things can become unprofitable to vendors, and even if it's their big thing now, that doesn't mean that they're going to stick around. So I guess I'd be curious about, and maybe OET can address this or somebody could, but the question of are there best practices in contract terms for systems of this scale and size that would require the vendor basically to continue to support you even after the 5-year contract is up? And maybe that's not what we should be doing, but I guess I'm concerned about the big investment and the long-term commitment of the vendor.
Madam Chair and members, my name is John Lally. I'm from the Office of Enterprise Technology. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should tell you that I worked for 25 years with the Revenue Department. And for 10 of those years, I was the Deputy Commissioner or Assistant Commissioner responsible for information systems. So I have some pretty clear perspectives on how they operate, and I hopefully not lost my objectivity in the years since I left the department. Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, it is standard practice when you buy a major system that the software itself is escrowed, which means if the company goes out of business and doesn't support it, we own the code and can then continue to operate it and then have the right to go in and modify the source code ourselves. And that's a protection against exactly what you're talking about.
I guess, Madam Chair, Mr. Lally, the follow-up would be, and we have the capacity, or we could, I suppose, then contract with somebody who is sort of the vendor goes away, somebody, another company is around to market their services as the people who kind of clean up the scraps after that, the wreckage of that relation, or those vendors disappearing.
Okay, Mr. Peterson
seems to want to say something about that. One thing I'd like to comment on that is we do have a number of VOR staff who are learning the actual application so that we can do the majority of the maintenance ourselves. We will have a number of fast employees on site for a while, and that's just the nature of the type of software that we have. But we are training our own people up so that we can maintain it.
Final follow-up, I guess, is I'm wondering also about project management issues that have arisen and whether those, you know, scope creep, of course, being the classic one, especially for a system of this scale. And even though it's off the shelf, there's, of course, a great deal of custom work, I'm sure, that's involved. So have you run into scope issues, project, and I should ask, what have been your project management issues, because I know there have been some, and are we documenting those, or is that part of an OET oversight so that when we do maps and other things, we can learn from some of those things?
Well, we certainly have had a concern from the beginning about the appetite of our employees to want to have more what we call site-specific code. could I have this little thing that I'm used to using part of this, a new system? So we've taken a pretty hard line on that, and we really have a high bar that needs to be cleared for any employee or division who wants to modify the code. Because if you modify the code, every time there's an update, we've got to go back in and make sure that little modification still works with the new version of the software, something we want to avoid. So I think it's safe to say we've minimized the degree of site-specific code in the program at this point. We're not terribly concerned about what we have right now. Do you want to add anything to that?
As Dan said, my background is as a project manager, and now I'm what is called the executive liaison on the project. We have a very good governance, in my opinion, a very good governance model in place. We have our senior management team, which we report to on a regular basis. We have an executive oversight group, which consists of the project managers from the project, myself, and Dan as a deputy, and our assistant commissioners. They oversee what is called our leadership advisory group, which are primarily our directors, and they meet every other week and to deal with exactly the type of issues that you do. And you really can't get any of this site-specific code done unless you really have some really good justification for it. So scope creep has been minimal. To date, we are on time and on budget with every milestone that we've done. We've rolled out our first tax site December 15th, right on time. I think that we are doing well. We also have three project managers full-time on it. The vendor has a project manager, we have a business project manager, we have a technical project manager, and I work with them closely and meet every other week where we have what we call a risk meeting. And Dan actually attends because that sets the agenda for our executive oversight meeting. So it'd take a lot longer than I'm sure that you guys want to do, but I assure you that there is a very good governance model in place.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe just to follow up on Representative Winkler's question, I'll make it a comment or a request. And I think, for me at least, sitting here thinking about a $16 million continued investment, I think maybe another layer deeper of information, maybe that's just a hard copy, if you could include for the committee members some kind of a packet that would give us a sense of how these, you know, governance structures are operating, maybe your status reports, the timeline and things. I things sound okay, but they always sound okay in these kind of forums. So whatever.
I
sit on the other side.
I will tell you also that we do work closely with the Office of Enterprise Technology. We participate with their project management office typically on a monthly basis. It tends to shoot up a little bit because of the holidays and the rest, but sit on the meeting. We also report regularly on a monthly basis to the enterprise project management over there, and all those status reports are there. We also have what is called a SharePoint site, which is part of our internal intranet, where there's all this documentation that people would like to. And I hate to bring this up, but we actually were part of a legislative audit last fall, which I don't think the audit report has been done yet, which provides you, I think, exactly the type of information that you're looking at.
Great, thank you. Those are the kinds of things that we've had a discussion here about whether there's really kind of strict compliance with statute relative to OET's oversight role and their risk assessments and things. So maybe it's just an offline request for me individually, but others on the committee would be interested in actually seeing some of that.
And if you ever would like to come over to the Department of Revenue, I'd be more than happy to show it to you. I will also tell you that we work very closely with the project management office over there, and created, because you were on over $10 million project, we needed to do a risk assessment, and probably worked with a company called Tavio Technologies, an independent contractor, to create that. And Rex Andre over at OET has said we're going to kind of use that as kind of a model as we go forward. So that's available too if you'd like to look at it.
How has that worked with the independent risk assessment team for projects? For this project, I guess, we're asking particularly.
This project was actually a little bit difficult because the statute requires that you have to have it done before you can spend 10% of the funding. Well, because of a project like this, our appropriation has been asked since like $29 million. The software alone is $4 million. And of course, the first thing they want to do when they come on site is install the software, and then they want to get paid for it. Well, we couldn't let them do that because we had to get the risk assessment done first. And you really, to have a best risk assessment, is you would like people on site so that they really understand, and the vendor can help you define some of the risks that they see, because then you know their product better. We did make a deal with them where we paid them half up front, and then 6 weeks later when the risk assessment was completed, then we paid them the balance. But that's because we had a good vendor who would negotiate with us. But if some of the other vendors would have said, nope, until you pay us, you don't get your software.
Well, that might be something that we need to put some buzzwords in that language.
Okay.
So I think every time, I don't know if this, Mr. Lally, this is directed to you or not, but I guess every time we do one of these things, we ought to be looking at what we have to fix, what's giving us troubles, and what do we have to fix with what we're telling people to do.
Madam Chair, and members,
but these are always, you know, they're always written to deal with the last thing that went wrong.
Madam Chair, and chasing failures isn't a particularly good guarantee of future success. If I might, one of the things that is very helpful to us in our oversight role is the way the Department of Revenue operates. They have, I think, was the word I used, it talked yesterday about the compliance cycle. Well, there's an equivalent cycle of performance management around information systems, from the planning process to making the business case to doing the execution and the selection and the implementation and the operation. And they have a very good portfolio management system in the Department of Revenue that allows that tracking to take place. Matter of fact, it was so good that we have implemented a good portion of the same kind of process at the state level and use it with many other agencies, which is one indication of the nature of the working relationship we have with the Department of Revenue. And I know from my past experience with Greg and with Ann that when we have a problem, when we see something we don't understand in a report, and we have multiple ways of getting information, I mean, there aren't any secrets in state government. We go and we call and we try to track it down and find out is there an issue or not. Generally speaking, the revenue department has had one of the most successful systems management functions in state government going back 15, 20 years. They have problems, I think, and Dan alluded to some of those earlier, with a lot of the smaller applications, those little individually one-up small systems that were developed to add up to those 100 and some systems. And that's what they're trying to address with this. I know, because this was before I left revenue, they were starting to do the analysis of what it would take to satisfactorily define the solution, identifying the specifics of what they needed well before they selected the software, which is the way we want agencies to do it. Concentrate on the business problem and do your selection at the end of that process. So we're very comfortable that what we've gotten, the engagement with, as he mentioned, Rex Andre, one of our most senior project managers in the department, has been a very strong ongoing relationship. So from that standpoint, I know past performance isn't always a predictor of future success, but in this case, their system effort over the last year and a half or so has been, as Greg said, right where it should have been. And we are as confident as we can be that it will continue to be so.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I know we're on a budget here.
Oh,
schedule.
Sorry, another Representative Holder. Thank you, Madam Chair. And quickly, can you talk to me a little bit about this system and security features and audit features? How do you know employees are using it lawfully, keeping the right amount of access to the right level of employee? Or talk to me a little bit about that.
Absolutely. This is something we spend a lot of time on. I work very closely with our Chief Information Security Officer. Not just with the integrated tax application, but all through the Department of Revenue. We have disclosure. We have regular classes where we teach people about it. We let them know that they are generally responsible if they leak people's data. We actually, unfortunately, have a number of individuals who do something silly and they lose their job because of it. You know, something as innocent as I look at my son's social security number, he will be discharged. We, in the Gentech system itself, it tracks everything that you look at with the name. We can actually go in and take a look and say, this person looked at this record at this point in time. This person changed that, so that we can control that. We take our stewardship of the data and of people and say that this is a voluntary tax system. By and large, people give us the information when we ask it of them. And we have to maintain that stewardship and that trust from the taxpayer.
And, Madam Chair, a little bit about security, external, how, I'm assuming some of the
firewalls and stuff are badge access, and yes. We've actually had a number of reviews, again, working with Chris Boozy with the OEC's security. We have great intrusion detection systems that we monitor and take a look at with the help of OEC. And we've had audits of that. And the external access for pieces like that, I do not know where we've ever had a real finding that anybody has lost any sleep over. Internally, over the last 2 years, because of the results of a legislative audit, we've worked very, very hard on what you call access control. What Dan can see, what he's allowed to see in the record, and how do we track that, monitor it, and when Dan leaves, make sure his access has done that, to the point where we put in some additional software so that we can keep track of that. So, again, are we as secure as anybody can be? Of course not. Are we a lot more secure than we were before? Yes, and we continually strive to get better and better. Additionally, every 3 years, and we just completed one, we have what is called an IRS safeguard review, because they're very, very protective of their federal tax information. And I just had a meeting this morning where we got a response just a little while ago to our audit, and they accepted all of their findings. They accepted our responses to the findings. So that's another piece that's out there.
And, Madam Chair, is the IRS review of your system, is that a public document?
I do not know. I would think not. It is not.
Thank you. Okay, we need to try and wrap this up so we can get to the Department of Finance next proposal. So
very quickly, Madam Chair, on the bottom of page 7, you see we've been talking about rollouts. Rollout 1 was completed on December 15th, and the best thing I heard about the completion of that rollout was from our folks involved in it, who said it was totally uneventful, because we were switching over from really the lab into real production for the taxes listed there: sales tax, Minnesota Care, petroleum, insurance, mortgage registry, indeed. You might not be surprised that we decided not to have the income tax be the first one that we experimented with. So it was not part of that rollout. You'll see some data at the bottom of the slide that's the number of taxpayer records that were converted during that changeover. So it was a very uneventful and very successful rollout. And it bodes well for the other rollouts coming. We're now all well into rollout number 2. And you can see the list of taxes there: withholding, corporate, S-corp, fiduciary partnership, business income, rural electric co-ops, and the dry cleaner tax are all part of rollout number 2. Rollout 3 will be the big enchilada, the income tax, and that's going to be in 2010, to be completed by 2010. And so by December of 2010. So that one will be probably the one where we'll be maybe have the highest level of anxiety, but we're confident that this is going to go very well. And then the fourth rollout, we pick up a few other stray taxes: cigarette, gambling, liquor, and non-tax debt. If you flip to the next slide at the top of page 8, the slide that says status of integrated tax system funding. I think that's, I want to focus on that for a few minutes. The total project cost over a 5-year period is $39.9 million. We've already received in funding from the 07 legislature a $12 million appropriation. Additional funding will come by through the agency redirecting money that would have been spent to maintain our old system. And we can divert over 5 years $11 million toward this new project. And finally, we had some funds that we put into a carry-forward account at finance, $450,000. I think it's from 200 or something like that. So ultimately, if you do the math, you'll see that 39.9 minus those three pieces leaves a balance of 16.45 million, which is what is in the governor's budget for the coming biennium. So that is pretty much the short version of the funding. If we get that money, we'll be very happy, Madam Chair, and this project will get done, and everyone will be happy. Taxpayers will be happy. I'd be happy to answer whatever questions you might have on funding.
And if you don't get it, or if you get 10% less of it, then what happens?
Well, Madam Chair, depending on how much less we're talking about, obviously we would try to find a way to keep this project going. With internal funds, if we can find them, we'll do our best. We know you have a lot of other competing, obviously, competing issues.
I guess one of the questions, I don't know if we get to ask it of you or of OEP or so forth, but how does all this fit into the consolidation of data centers? And this is the thing that, has anyone asked you how you're going to be consolidated into a data center?
The Office of Enterprise Technology has already owned our data center. We were one of the first agencies. I guess I can turn this over to Dan if you want to talk. But so, right now, we're in.
Okay. Do we need anything more than that?
Okay.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair, Mr. Salamy, have you identified alternative funding sources or funding mechanisms to a general fund appropriation of $16.5 million this session?
We have not. We know that if we don't get what we need, we're obviously going to have to look internally to see what we can do. But beyond that, other streams of money we have not identified.
Okay, back to telling them how maps is going to work. Who gets to start?
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you for having us here today. Stephanie Andrews from the Department of Finance, which hopefully sometime will be renamed Minnesota Management and Budget. Here with me is the Assistant Commissioner for County Services, Lori Moe, and Commissioner of Administration, Dana Badgero. It's a nice thing, actually, that you heard about Revenue System first, because you see a project there that, as you know, has been in the works for a couple of years, and we're at a different point with the MAPS project, but a lot of the same themes I think you're going to hear as you hear more about this project. Basically, if you look at the materials in your handout, you see those four puzzle pieces, and I just want to remind everybody that we're talking about the procurement and the accounting piece of the enterprise IT structure here. HR payroll is the Semaphore system. We're not talking about that today. And the data warehouse is basically the system that feeds off of the accounting system and the HR payroll system. Our proposal in the governor's budget is to replace the current MAP system, the accounting and procurement system, which is what MAP stands for, to provide new tools for state government to keep track of money, control activities, procure goods and services. I think you all are pretty well aware of the scope and size of the MAP system, so I won't bore you with a lot of statistics, but important to remember that basically this is where every dollar that state government spends, this is the system that it goes through. There are 267,000 vendors that use MAP, with another 50,000 vendors added each year. It handles $4.5 million transactions, and has again, touches every committee, every program that you know of and that you work with in your other work. Wanted to give you a sense in the slide titled "Where We Are Now," just of what's happened up until this point. Back in May of 2006, a number of groups across state government, cross agency teams, ultimately 130 subject matter experts, or SMEs as we refer to them, from over 30 state agencies, started working together to really start drilling down into our existing business processes and looking at the way that we currently do financial management across state government. We talk about this as the as-is part of the system of the replacement project. So they've spent a lot of time looking at what actually happens today, and then out of that started looking at what we call the to-be part of the process. They looked at our 24, identified the 24 most critical accounting and procurement processes, and started talking about ways that those might change with a new system going forward. We also had parts of our project team go on visits to other states, similar to what you heard Revenue talking about in the integrated tax process. Our team went out to talk to other states that had either launched similar projects, were in the middle of similar projects, or had already been through implementation. Ms. Moe can update you on some more of the details that we learned there, but I think overall we got a good sense of what the various tools provided and also what the various process pitfalls and opportunities were in that process. So a lot of valuable information learned from that, and that was largely financed with the planning appropriation that came from this committee, and so thank you for allowing us to do that. We think it puts us in a better place for this project going forward. The business case and the RFP have been developed for the replacement project, and the RFP was released in late January. We're currently looking at, we're waiting for proposals to be submitted to us later in March. When the project started, it's important to know that basically we had the twofold goals for it. One was, you've heard a lot about the increasing technical risk of the MAP system. Just as significant in the process was also to look at how we could leverage commercially available technology, moving away from the tremendously customized system that had developed over the years since MAPS was first implemented in the mid-90s, and trying to use that technology to drive process improvement and operational efficiency. Understanding that the procurement and accounting processes in state government are really the two core administrative functions, again, felt as if we needed to pull people together from across state agencies to do that work. We also worked with Silvestre Teal and Associates, an information consultant group, to prepare a business case on the project, and would be happy to make that available to you if you're interested. Part of what it helps you see is some of the work that's gone into evaluating, again, what we currently have in place and thinking about how that might change as we go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You just actually kind of hit on the question I had, and that would be the business case. Maybe if we could take a look at that. And my recollection, actually, I think I looked at that once, and it was pretty high level. It was kind of benchmarked against other states' experiences, and maybe didn't go all the way down to how you would redesign business functions and how things would actually be improved, particularly here in Minnesota. Did it get taken to the next level?
Madam Chair, President Downey, let me start, and Assistant Commissioner Moe can fill in. The business case, this piece of it is pretty high level. As those groups, the cross-agency groups that we were talking about, as they started looking at those 24 processes, they did some workflow analysis, and so there's pretty detailed information available, and we can certainly make that available to you, but let Ms. Moe give you some more details. Uh-huh.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Just the comment that I'll add to that is that while we've done significant work with a large cross-agency group in looking at different business processes and exploring ways where we can do things more efficiently and more effectively, we know that our work's not done in that area. The final decisions regarding business process changes won't be made until we know the product that we've selected and the implementation options available to us with that product. Our intention is to use the software we select in the most unmodified form possible and take advantage of the best practices that are embedded within that software and that have been developed over the course of working with other users for a long history.
Madam Chair, a follow-up to Representative Downey. This may be to Commissioner Badgero or either the other two from testifiers from Finance, but is Department of Administration's lean process analysis something that makes sense to do as part of this? Has it been done? It just seems like an outsider looking at how you conduct business might be somebody to help redesign process potentially as this goes forward.
Madam Chair, I'm Dana Badgero, Commissioner of Administration, Representative Winkler. We're relatively early on in our lean deployment. We're just at a year. We have had 55 Kaizen events. We're hoping to do that tenfold within the next year or two. I think the lean process is a particularly good tool to be used as we look at these business processes, but to date it has not.
Madam Chair, I guess, or I don't know if Ms. Null or
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I just wanted to say that I think, too, it's something related to where we are in the project, because, again, part of what we have tried to do is to identify what are the key processes that we need to look at when we start talking about a new product. And at that point, I think it's absolutely appropriate and will be very useful to look at Lean and perhaps other methods, too, to analyze, given what the software offers us, how do we have to change our process to be able to make best use of it without customizing. Commissioner Salamone talked about the various interests of staff in terms of wanting to get their specific codes for the programs that they're working on. We're going to have some of the same agencies across, the same issues across agencies, and that's where Lean will be really vital to saying, okay, here's what the product's going to give you, and here's how you're going to change your process to get there. But at this point, we haven't done that.
I guess that's a follow-up question. And this sounds like a little bit different. I thought the goal was to complete a very highly detailed business case with a very thorough analysis of business process, and then once you have that, roll that up into your RFP. And I guess maybe it doesn't translate exactly, but I guess the question is, have we done enough of that analysis to be selecting the vendor, or is there a reason to select the vendor and then do the process analysis thereafter? Or I'm just trying to reconcile the kind of what I'm hearing from two different...
Madam Chair, Representative Wicklund, it's a good question, and I think that part of it goes to the fact that there are only a very few vendors that have a product available for this kind of an activity. And so we know we have two or three options out there, and going too far and saying here's how we want it to work doesn't make as much sense until we know what the specific offering is on that activity in that product. And so there'll be some customization and configuration, and that's as Ms. Moore talked about, but it's a little different, I think, for that reason.
Madam Chair, members, the one thing I'll add to that is through the course of our analysis, both on current processes and areas where things might be changed, we then went on and developed the business requirements for inclusion in the RFP document, which ultimately totaled in excess of 2,000 specific business requirements. So we did get down to a level of detail in that process.
Okay. This slide maps are central to all state activities. I think you get that, so I'm not going to go through it in any detail. Just a little background again about where MAPS started. First selected in 1992, operational in 1995. Mainframe applications were the norm in the early 90s when the system was designed, not web-based applications. There are a lot of things that MAPS currently does, or the way it does them, you don't even think of anymore. Drop-down menus, things like that you just assume are part of what you're working with, and MAPS doesn't have those built in. It was built in COBOL in 1959 language. My sister's turning 50 now, and she was born in 1959. Cell phones cost $4,000. They had talk times of 30 minutes. A lot has changed since then. People have done a great job across state government keeping the system going. We have done a very good job. We think of getting we have more than recovered our investment in that system. I think at this point, as we look at it again, the technical risk analysis that we've done of the system shows that we have some fairly significant possibilities of system failure coming along, and we have looked at a number of mitigation strategies, and we can share those with you in more detail if you would like. We go through basically looking at if this were to happen, and Ms. Moore will talk about this a little bit more too, if this were to happen, how much does it cost to mitigate that, and what's the chance of that mitigation strategy working? And as we look at it again, we see about an $8.5 million possibility. But, as you well know, that's risk. Could go for another 20 years. We don't think so. But we don't know when there'll be system failure. We do know that system failure isn't likely to be a big bang kind of a thing. It's more the continuing degradation of that system performance and the impact that that has on the agencies using it. And that's where we already see significant issues with that.
Madam Chair?
Okay.
Just a question about that, Commissioner Andrews. I'm not yet a lawyer. I hope soon to be joining the horrible ranks of Representative Winkler and others. But I know that risk assessment is often the potential calamity. In terms of coming up with settlement amounts and whatever, the potential calamity multiplied by the likelihood of that calamity happening. Does this $8.5 million represent the potential calamity, or the calamity times risk potential?
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, it actually adds up the, it isn't weighted. I think what we probably should do is move to the slide that says key risks with current MAPS, and
okay.
Commissioner Moll can maybe walk through in some more detail.
I think just to, before Commissioner Moll gets to just background on where I'm going, is just feeling a little surly today. I think somebody else asked the same question. I think it was actually the chair. What if we don't do it? And how necessary really is this? I just want to have that test met, and I don't know what the test really is yet.
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, I think that the key question there really gets back to that. There's other slides that we didn't go over about how much the system affects everything we do. And so while, again, we are working very hard to be sure we have mitigating strategies in place so that we don't miss a payment, we don't have anybody not getting the money they expect to get, whether it's a school district or an individual or a local government, the impact of a system breakdown is so severe that it's important to move forward. So there is some waiting in that sense. Again, there's also just the continuing impact of the lack of productivity in that system on state operations, where in a time when things are as tight as they are, everybody's trying to figure out how to do things better. We have this dinosaur of a system sitting in the middle. That means people have to spend time maintaining the system and making sure it works. That's across state government. That's in IT offices across state government. And that, to us, seems like a luxury that we really can't afford right now.
What's the risk of not having anyone who knows how to do COBOL around here?
Madam Chair, members, that is one of the risks that is on our list. As
do you have people taking refresh courses in COBOL while they're somewhere still able
to? Representative, my dad is still alive. He's in Florida, but
okay, Madam Chair, he'd be expensive to hire. That's the problem. Even if we had them on staff or wanted to hire them, there are a few people around. They're pretty expensive. And we think we'll be losing them soon. Nothing against your father.
From payroll, you mean.
The people retired.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. No doubt about it, COBOL language, is an antiquity, and you're exactly right. And why should we keep investing in a language that is probably at the point of outlived its usefulness and should be just held around long enough to get onto something else? The biggest thing is that this committee has heard the legislative auditor, and we've dealt with other auditing risks. The one big thing that this kind of a new system can do is, if it is built, when you build it, and you keep those kinds of things in mind, that's why it's so important. I understand just the mechanical parts of executing a transaction, but I think you can get tremendous value here in many of these legislative auditor things. Your MAP system can be a huge benefit to you in just like they talked about with Department of Revenue, tracking everything that's done in the system, everybody who does something, who does that. There are a lot of things you can do that I think will get us a long way, not just towards this technology, but to some of the other things we've talked about in the construction of it in regards to some of the audit processes. That can be very, very, very helpful. That I think the COBOL language or this line-by-line coding just doesn't lend itself to very well.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, when I get to the slide on benefits, that is indeed one of the benefits that we'll talk about, both on the improved security and improved audit trail on transactions. But first, maybe I'll talk a little bit more on slide 7 about the MAPS risk and what is included in that $8.5 million figure. We have been monitoring risk to the MAP system for a number of years now. We've been aware of the aging nature. The system has not been upgraded since 1998, but at the same time, we wanted to make sure that we didn't move on this too early and that we did get the most value out of the system as was reasonable. But we have risks that we're facing both in the area of the mainframe, the desktop, and in staffing. And one thing we keep in mind as we continue to monitor these risks is that a replacement project for a system of this magnitude is 2 years minimum. And so if funding is approved this session, we're looking at a go-live implementation date of July of 2011 or the beginning of fiscal year 12. So the waiting until the system breaks and then replacing it is not an option. We have to continue to monitor these risks and know that we have mitigation strategies available that will carry us for that at least 2-year period. The risks on the mainframe side are primarily that the mainframe environment continues to change while maps stays stationary. The operating system is typically upgraded every year, and every time that operating system is upgraded, there's a risk to an incompatibility with the map system. Similarly, on the desktop, the newest desktop environments will not run maps, and this is not just a theoretical issue. We know that maps will not run on Vista 64, and we have already heard from some user agencies that are moving at least some of their users to a Vista 64 operating system. This may be because of other applications they're running or other needs that they have. And in those cases, their options are going to be limited. They may need to operate an older version, a different computer, for their map transactions, and then the newer operating system to support their newer applications. And what that means is that then an older operating system with its related security risks are part of their network. And then the staffing risk loss, as we said, we've been experiencing retirement. The newer workers are not being trained in this technology, although certainly they could be trained in this technology, it's not the area probably the newer workers are interested in pursuing. And then finally, just a couple more words on that $8.5 million. That is the cost that we've identified for the solutions that we would put in place if we ran into these issues in the coming 2 years. For example, on the mainframe side, it's not the cataclysmic cost of maps being down multiplied by the probability of that map or of the mainframe failure. Rather, it's the actual cost of operating a mainframe with an old operating system in its own separate region and running that separately just for purposes of supporting maps, while the newer operating system was used for other applications from other agencies. The next slide is on the cost estimates. These were developed with assistance from an outside consultant who has worked with a number of states across the country on their system replacement projects. They were originally developed in 2006 and have been updated this last fall for increases in the cost of labor, facilities, hardware, and software, et cetera.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps it's again the surliness coming out, but I'm hearing I guess I'd like to be forthcoming if I'm in bomb out there, but and I very much understand the need, and I think we all have tried to milk along our own PCs or laptops and deal with, I couldn't get any online media, any video or anything on my old Mac, and finally, set it up and made the investment. It's like, oh, this stuff actually works. And I get that as a very clear analogy. And I'm hearing that we might end up saving a lot of time and even a lot of FTEs who are currently dedicated to doing essentially what are workarounds, that we might no longer need. And I'm just wondering if we search after efficiencies and streamlining, that I understand there's an investment here, but are we also then capturing savings that actually are bottom line savings that we can point to and say to the public, to our constituents, this investment will save this amount of these hours and this amount of time. And I just haven't seen it yet. I'm not elbow deep yet in the numbers. Have you, what's happening there on that end?
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, we don't have savings as part of the proposal. Part of that reflects the fact that you have a fair amount of people who have been covering and probably could better be used but still are needed doing other things. That isn't. It's also a relatively long implementation period, and we all are still looking at what the impact of that is. I think that across the enterprise, as you know from the other things that OET is working on and what you've heard from revenue, across the enterprise we're looking at down the road what does state government look like on the IT front. MAPS will have a very large impact on what agencies can do. Some of the specific examples, when you put in a new map, people won't have to take time making sure that it runs, but they probably will still need to be doing some of the work looking at making sure that electronic transactions, which we're now doing online, that those are working appropriately, that audit controls are put in place so that those can be done online. That's still another activity. So I think we see it more as a productivity improvement and an efficiency improvement, and at this point in time there aren't any savings built into the proposal in front of us.
Follow up, Madam Chair. This sort of reminds me of what I think we've heard Representative Chair Pawlowski complain about a little bit is agencies often saying that we can absorb new mandates or absorb new activities in small ways. And I understand exactly what you're saying, Commissioner, but I think there's also this, I'm hearing a little bit of that absorption language, that they'll be absorbed into other duties that need to happen. And I'm just after a more clear accounting of the fact that savings will happen and that there are tasks that are not being allocated enough resources to that need more attention. And I think that this goes to kind of the structural performance budgeting issue that we need to have a clearer and more transparent accounting of what those tasks are so we can make a clear decision on projects that we're going to waylay through our cuts, $3 or $4 billion at a minimum. So I guess I'll keep my surly mouth shut here from here on forward, but I hear the need, and I think I'm getting more and more convinced of the value of it, but I also want to know more about how the transformation is going to show up on the bottom line.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions on the cost page. The outside consultants versus state employees ratio is about 80% external, and I know that's probably at the high end of the use of external consultants for a project like this, and there's risk either way. I'm just curious why you ended up where you did with leveraging heavily on external consulting resources.
Madam Chair, Representative, as we look at various models for implementation team of a system of this type, the advice we got from discussions with other states as well as the consultant that helped us with the planning phase was that a ratio of 2-to-1 was optimal to ensure knowledge transfer from the contractors to the state team, but to have adequate expert resources from the contractor side to guide the project, so that is the assumption that was built into the numbers. But of course, contractor positions are considerably more expensive than state staff positions.
So the 2-to-1 ratio was in terms of people, not dollars then?
Yes. Correct.
Yeah, okay, thank you. And then if I could mention an overriding concern, you mentioned, and this is kind of my critique of the business case, and I share Representative Kalin's line of questioning and concern here as well. So that business case was modeled on other states, and I mean, the risk there is that you're you're just drawing conclusions based on averages, and you know, we don't know which side of the bell curve we might be on. We could be right in the middle and we're fine, or we could be at one end or the other and we could be in a heap of trouble if we're at the wrong end. And so I'm really concerned if this estimate is based on kind of benchmarks against other states, because our circumstance is not going to be the same. Did you kind of drill down a more detailed project plan and really, really model this to Minnesota's implementation, or are we really relying on some of those national averages?
Madam Chair, Representative, we did do additional research into other states, and what we found as we talked with our counterparts is that in many cases, Minnesota is really starting from a different place than from where they started their project. We're fortunate that we did do the statewide systems project back in the early 90s, and we're currently starting from a position where our broad array of state agencies are using a common system already, and that we have some standardization of business processes already in place, and versus some states that are undertaking these projects are currently using systems that are individual to specific agencies and so forth. So I think there was consideration of where Minnesota is starting from as we embark on this project.
So, but to answer my question, this is based on an average and a set of assumptions, not on an actual Minnesota specific plan that we've developed, even if it's at a high level. And so maybe a corollary question would be, have we gotten any validation from the vendor community that we guessed right?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have currently got the RFP on the street, and we'll be receiving the proposals from the vendor community later in March, and so it'll be at that time we'll see specific proposals. I'd be happy to share with you the detail behind what we have included in our business case. I'm not quite certain how much detail you're looking for.
Thank you. I would appreciate that. That'd be great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I wonder if I might interject, because I know I want to come back to the, I represent the P in MAPS. I'm in the procurement system, and so I'm here today representing that letter, and I can tell you that the replacement of the procurement system will represent true, provable product, a process improvement, and let me just give you sort of an overview of what that will look like. Today we do 300,000 transactions a year through this antiquated system, where purchase orders and requisitions are generally done on written form, sometimes on shadow systems. The entire purchase transaction is done in paper. And let me just give you a demonstrable.
On my in our procurement department, and I just said, "Give me something you're looking at today." This is a relatively small procurement. It happens to be for medical transcription services. This happens to be the file of all the documentation received from the agencies, including several versions of the requisition and so forth. These are the proposals. Multiply this times 6, because we asked for 6 copies of the proposals to be provided by each vendor. So today, we do all of that, and then at the end of the day, we enter it into MAPS. None of this is automated. None of it. There are various handoffs, signatures, waiting time, documents being transferred back and forth between buildings. The process is cumbersome, and it is anything but lean. Let me contrast that with the e-procurement system that we will finally get with this system. We will be behind many, many states who have already implemented e-procurement systems. With an e-procurement system, if I'm in an agency and I have a need for a good or service, I go online, much as I would go online to Amazon. I would find the vendor's catalog. I would pick the product that I want. Automatically, the system would determine whether that was available to me. It would allow me to, at the same time, enter my requisition,
and have audit processes in place to ensure that I'm authorized to buy that item, that is an authorized item for me. It would automatically refer it by email to the people who need to approve it and sign off on it. Bear in mind, this is all electronic. I would then put it in my shopping cart. The shopping cart would then uncover the money. All of this process now is done offline and in separate parallel processes. From the vendor community, the vendor is going to be able to submit this material electronically. All of the catalogs will be online electronically. So we will, the process, it will be incredibly truncated and made much more efficient. But let me just explain what else we get with this system. We get really good spend intelligence, and we do not have that now. We have overlaid a kind of a kludge system that mines the data out of maps, but we still do not really know what agencies are spending today. It's estimated that of the $1 billion that is spent on goods and services, as much as $300 million may be maverick spend. Spend that the map system is not capable of checking as to whether it is an authorized or that is an approved enterprise standard. So we have spend intelligence. We get the additional volume leverage. We prove already on our enterprise contracts that we're saving on average 19% from previous five. So there's a category at which we know tangibly we can get at savings by having better spend intelligence. We also know that we'll be able to reduce inventories and carrying costs. Right now, we've got about $17.5 million in inventories right now because of cycle times. This time, the cycle times are instant, so therefore, we can reduce our carrying costs. So I guess what I'm really saying is if you want to look at a process improvement, this is a purchase-to-pay process that is as lean as it gets. And it's about time, I think, that we fall in place with the other states. It will be a tremendous boon to not only the people in my department who are processing this paper and these orders. I can tell you many, many more features that will be available. Evaluations can be done online. We can score proposals online. There are all kinds of tests that can be applied and to be able to ensure that we're getting the best price, and so on and so forth. So I think I just want to emphasize we talk a lot about the accounting and the payment system, but this procurement piece, which, by the way, also has not been updated since 1998 and is no longer supported by the vendor and has not been for many years, is really probably more fragile than is the accounting system.
One final follow-up, if I could. So are those, you just rattled through probably 20 benefit statements there, and you appeared to have quantification behind those. Is that documented in the business case document and that we could see and have some more confidence in the benefit?
Madam Chair and Representative, what the members are asking is that we're in this, you probably are facing your most sympathetic people in the legislature, you in this room at this point, and we're going to have to go to, we're going to go to our caucuses and say that this is worth more than sick children or blind adults or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I think what Representative Downey's trying to do is to say that any numbers you could give us would be useful in doing this. It's obviously if something's not rolled out until, 2012 or whatever it is, it's not going to help us this much in this biennium. But we start talking about the structural deficit that we're in. That's something else that we have to look at.
Madam Chair, the business case does indeed quantify cost savings at a fairly high level, with not a lot of finite granularity, but it does quantify cost savings in various categories, including improved productivity. Obviously, those are at least 2 years out, and in fact, the business case had them a full 1 year after implementation, so then we would be talking 3 years out before those savings would be realized. But the categories are there. Numbers are there. There's $2.5 million, for example, in staff productivity improvements per year once you reach full implementation. I'd have to say that those are, I don't want to call them swags, but they're good estimates, but that's what they are, they're estimates. I can prove, I think I can prove the kinds of efficiencies that we will get in the procurement process. I know that from corralling maverick spend, we will achieve additional savings. And so I know that there are additional categories which we can quantify, and I believe they are, again, at the high level in the business case.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I think, Commissioner Badgerow, you did a wonderful job.
as always, when I hear you present. But one of the things, too, is that when you do those business cases, there are certain underlying assumptions that you use in your savings. Will those assumptions also be part of that so that we can also have a look at those? Because those are really critically important to the calculations.
There are assumptions against this, I'm sure there are.
I'm looking forward to seeing that. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Badgerow, I think you're singing my tune here a little bit, but and forgive my naivete on this specific subject. You did reference some savings that we've already been able to retain. How have those showed up on our bottom line, and how are they being used or implemented in the budget, and how can we be sure that we're going to be able to account for those in 10 and 11 and then in 12 and 13? Because that we would like to cover sick children mm-hmm. with these savings.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Kevin, those savings are being enjoyed not by state agencies alone. State agencies, in fact, only represent 36% of our purchasing volume. They're being enjoyed by K-12, higher education, local units of government who also buy off of these same contracts. So that those savings are being spread over a vast number of government entities. It is really almost impossible, it is impossible, particularly given our systems, to be able to track who has bought what at what price to be, I suppose that's another benefit of this system. We will be able to determine who is buying what and therefore be able to quantify and pinpoint where the savings are occurring. Today we cannot do that with our system.
We are going to have to stop because people, and we will obviously get to the question of the financing at a different meeting. We do have the minutes are before us. Representative Clinton moves the adoption of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. The minutes are adopted. And we will have to adjourn the meeting. Sorry. We don't.